Thank you all for being here. I wish you a very warm welcome to the seminar. I hope we'll have a stimulating at least 2 hours discussing on the basis of this exciting new report that's being launched from EBA. Well, first, just as a matter of procedure, I'll just tell you what EBA is. EBA is a government committee, was created in, more than 4 years ago. It's an independent, my name is Eva Littman, and I'm also a member of this EBA committee that is tasked with producing evaluations and studies of relevance to Swedish aid policy. And I think it's important to stress that we work independently. We choose the topics, our reports and studies independently. And also the authors of these reports, they also work independently. We like to say that we are doubly independent. Our seminars, like this one, are of course intended to form a meeting place, in a sense, between research and analysts and practitioners and politicians. So instead of just having the written reports, we actually want to start a conversation around the topics treated in our studies. So that's why we hope that when you've been here, you may not agree with everything, but you take these questions and issues back home and you continue to discuss them. What we'll do, as you know, you've seen, this report has been written by three eminent Norwegian researchers, Hilde Reinertsen and Desmond McNeil, both from Oslo University, and Christian Bjørkdal from Bergen University. And things often are with EBA, they came to us and they had a proposal, they wanted to do something. And I think this, in a sense, is also typical of how we work, how we choose our topics. They come from outside parties. But we may also define issues and we will issue calls for proposals. They will present their report. After that, we will have some comments from the two current heads of evaluation unit at NORAD, Per Øyvind Bastø, and Joachim Olander, who is chief evaluator at CEDA. I understand this is your new title. And we're also very pleased to count on the participation of Professor Emeritus Evert Vedung, who is, in fact, I think, the grand old man of Swedish evaluation research, and Cecilia Jungman, who is an experienced independent evaluator with long track record in aid evaluation. But we'll also have an opportunity for you to engage in the discussion. This is the program. We'll have like 2 hours for the seminar proper, and then we hope that you'll want to stay for another half hour to continue informal discussions over a cup of coffee. So, without further ado, I think I'll invite the authors of the report to make their presentation. So, Hilde, Desmond, and Christian, please.
Thank you. My name is Hilde Reinertsen. I'm a Norwegian researcher, and my two colleagues, Christian Bjørkdal and Desmond McNeil, will come later throughout this introduction. It will take one part each. I would first like just to start by thanking EBA so much for both, of course, funding the study, but also for the extremely interesting and engaging cooperation, both with the administrative staff, first Emma Östakir and then Per Trulsson, who has organized everything perfectly, but of course also the reference group, which has been extremely useful and helpful and engaging in our discussions. And their participation has been very important for the actual report as well, because, as I will come back to, it has been an iterative process, not just us sitting and writing and sort of submitting the final version. But let's get to the point here. The dual purpose of aid evaluation. It's stated both by OECD-DAC, the SIDA, NORAD evaluation units, and of course other similar agencies, that there's a dual purpose, both accountability and learning. And it's often then portrayed as they are, of course, different, but they are compatible. There's no inherent contradiction here, or tensions, or trade-offs potentially. That's a starting point. But at the same time, within the field of development aid, and especially among aid evaluation experts and units, there is a long-standing discussion of the problem of learning. I will not get into the details of all these reports, but they form a very important background, because there is a problem here that seems to be very difficult to solve. And the same question keeps coming back. Why are we not learning more? What does it take to learn form evaluations and so forth? These are just some of the examples, and the report, of course, have the detailed quotes and references. So our approach then is different from these studies about learning as such, because we wanted to look at the two purposes in combination, learning and accountability. They are portrayed as two sides of the same coin, as a twin objective, dual purpose. But we went into the study with a really strong hypothesis. We tried to sort of push how strongly can we formulate the relation between these two. So we started saying, well, the concern for accountability itself impedes learning. Put strongly that you are incompatible. And we studied this then on three levels. We operationalized it in this way. We studied evaluation texts, so the actual reports. We looked into evaluation as a process, and then the wider system in which each and every evaluation report is a part, of course. So this is how we proceeded into the study. The report itself has six parts. I will briefly go through the first and second, and then Christian will give you the main points from three and four, so the text and processes, and then Desmond will finalize with the systems and the conclusions, also the recommendations, which we hope can sort of be helpful for framing the further discussion. But let's get to the conclusion. This very briefly sums up what we believe is the how to describe the relation between accountability and learning in aid evaluation. It involves fundamental trade-offs in practice. So this is a revised version or a modified version of our initial hypothesis, because throughout the study we were constantly having new empirical findings, discussions with actors. So the initial hypothesis was modified when it met with the empirics. But still, these are trade-offs we hold. And they emerge both in the texts, in the processes, so in the actual work of evaluation, and in the systems, in the way we set up aid evaluation in our public administrations. Learning, we find, may of course happen. We're not saying that learning does not happen. No one really says that it never happens. Also in these studies that I showed you earlier, they are often pointing to how learning may happen for individuals. The problem is organizational learning. And the same, especially in our interviews, people stress this repeatedly, that for those involved in evaluation processes, for program officers involved in the project being evaluated, and, of course, for the evaluation team, the actual consultants doing the work, they may learn quite a lot. And at this level, it may be more easy to combine the purposes of learning and accountability. What is much harder to achieve is to synthesize and transfer learning from these specific evaluation processes, from the individual projects and programs, to this wider context, or to the sort of the big learning, as one of our informants very nicely put it. So the further removed you are from the actual processes and the field, it's the learning gets much more difficult. And we find there's also quite exaggerated expectations among many, both in the public and in the field itself, of what an evaluation report and process may actually contribute to, what it may do, what it may solve. Just very briefly, our approach, we combine several different kinds of academic backgrounds. You can read more thoroughly about this in the report: history, rhetoric, and political economy, as well as science and technology studies, which is a field where, at least in my part of the field, you study knowledge production in itself in the public administrations. We had some fundamental questions, and they're very open, and that's very deliberate. We did not define what learning and accountability was on beforehand. We counted your experiences, the lived experience of learning accountability. How are they handled in practice? Who learns? To whom are we accountable? And those kinds of questions we asked. Further, the very practical work of evaluation: who writes, who reads, and ultimately who learns? And this fundamental question, of course: evaluation for whom? Who are we evaluating for? We did a very broad and extensive mapping of work done by evaluation units in both Sweden and Norway. We did detailed analysis of 20 reports, very small sample, obviously, of the wide range of reports available in all these databases that we went through. Then we interviewed some key senior evaluation managers in both countries. In total, they have been heads of units. They have sort of been in key positions for the whole 40-year period that we looked into. And as I mentioned in the beginning, EBA and the reference group and the informants have also been extremely important in not only giving us information, but also sort of confronting us back, in a sense. That's why, obviously, our hypothesis was modified, because we wanted to have a discussion also throughout the process of writing. There are obviously limitations to this research design. We could always have interviewed more people, we could have looked at more reports, we could have talked to users, partners, and recipients, but that would then involve a much larger study, which we would have loved to do, obviously, but we didn't have that possibility in this project. Then this combination of history and comparing two countries obviously means that we cannot focus as much on the current events, and that neither of the countries were really in-depth. But the point was to see them in combination. And then if you go into the theory of science part of this, then you can discuss, of course, at length how to combine the hypothesis with explorative methods, which is a very lively debate within theory of science. But still, we really hold that this combination of historical and comparative approach is extremely illuminating, because it contextualizes what happens today in each of the countries. And what you find then, of course, that there are no perfect solutions here. They have constantly shifted in both Norway and Sweden how aid evaluation as such, and especially the relation between accountability and learning, has been balanced and institutionalized. You have different kinds of evaluation systems: decentralized and centralized, external and internal evaluation functions, and also the very sort of independence and integration of the evaluation function in the wider system has shifted several times, and we detail this especially in the appendix of the report. And so what this comparative approach means is that you really see that there are unresolved tensions here, and that they cause numerous practical trade-offs for the staff working hard to evaluate and synthesize findings. And we would like to finish this first part by noting that we're not the only one talking about this issue. Accountability and learning has for long been debated within aid evaluation communities, and it has had sort of an upsurge recently. This is just examples of a blog post by Caroline Heider, who is in the IEG, in the World Bank Group. There was she is then commenting on this forum section in Evaluation Connections, which is a magazine from the European Evaluation Society. There are four reports here, just to illustrate that this has been noted for, well, I think the first was in 2001 and most recent from OECD in 2016. This issue is currently being discussed and it's increasingly so. So based on both these publications from the field, practice-based publications, and the more independent academic research, we did a mapping of literature and came up with these four main categories, you could say, main positions that are often held in the debate. That the accountability and learning as this dual purpose, they are complementary. It's the first position. The second is that the two, there might be tensions, but they're reconcilable. It's a dilemma, but you can solve it. The third is, which is where we land for our study, that there are trade-offs and there are problematic issues here that we need to discuss. Whereas the fourth holds quite sort of controversially then that there is an irreconcilable contradiction. And the further you get from the field, the more confrontational, you could say, the positions are. I will end there and then leave the next session to Christian.
All right, so the first level of analysis, as Hilde referred to, is the reports themselves. So we approached evaluation as texts, as a set of texts. And our first question, again, was very open. Of course, we had our hypothesis to start with, but the questions we asked when approaching the text was quite open. What is this document anyway? What is an evaluation report? So we find first that there's diversity in form, in content, and also in the context in which it is used. So you have program reviews, you have theme-oriented evaluations, country evaluations, real-time evaluations, and so on. You know all these genres. But across these different forms, it's quite a consistent genre. That has to do probably with many things, but not least with the terms of reference, which are very, very similar. It's quite a set format. And one aspect of that that we've found interesting and which we focus on is the fact that they lay down analysis description that are supposed to make a transition to recommendations. That's what you find in almost every set of terms of reference. And of course, the reports are products of the terms of reference. So, the fact that these reports look the way they do has fundamentally to do with the terms of reference. Now, these reports are fundamentally documents that document. So on the one hand, it's quite clear that evaluation reports serve the function of accountability. They show to everyone involved, to practitioners, to people higher up in the system, maybe even to aid beneficiaries, at least in theory, what's going on. You know, what has happened? What are the consequences? What is the output of this particular effort? But there's also another expectation. We're not quite sure whether we want to say that there is another function of these reports, but there is another expectation to these reports, and it is that they should enhance learning. And there are quite a few concrete statements to that effect. So in Norad's handbook, for instance, it reads, an evaluation report, no matter how good it is, has little value unless it is being used. So there's this idea that the evaluation report needs to feed back into the system. There needs to be something to take from the report and do something with it. It needs to go somewhere. This content is part of the terms of reference. Our main finding, though, in going through this sample of reports, is that we find they're relatively strong on description and analysis. I mean, that's also in quantitative terms, where the emphasis lies. The emphasis in numerical terms is on description and analysis. So the main part of most reports lies there. But they're also quite strong, I would say, in qualitative terms when it comes to description analysis relative to the next part, the lessons learned and the recommendations. And in particular, we find weaknesses when it comes to making that transition from analysis and description to recommendations. First of all, we find that relevant causes of either successes or failures or particular outcomes and also important factors of the context in which that aid effort is played out that play a big role in describing the outcomes and analyzing why that outcome was a consequence of the particular effort in question. They're not factored into the recommendations. So there may be a long list of relevant reasons why things went as they did, and that plays a big role in the description, but it doesn't make its way into the recommendations. So we find there is a disconnect between these two parts of the report. This means that because the terms of reference still ask evaluators to have recommendations, they need to come from somewhere. And our idea is that they come, in many cases, from somewhere else than the description and analysis that precedes the recommendations. That means that they're in many cases are either too specific and kind of micro-level oriented. So in one, this is just as an example, one recommendation was that this project needs more cash, which is very micro-level. That might be true, but it doesn't give you anything to take from that particular project or evaluation. In other cases, it's just too general and apparently unworkable, at least from seen from where we stand. So another example is that in one of the reports, they said, for instance, in order to achieve the results we want here, we need to foster better ethics. Which, you know, how do you do that? The problem is a lack of ethics, so we need to foster ethics. Very, very general and not very practicable. There's also a tendency we find towards politicized, that may be a controversial word, but let's use it, politicized or conservative recommendations that seem to exclude any potential challenges to the aid institution. This connects back to the first bullet point there, that certain of these factors that seem to make the aid effort very, very difficult or in some cases even quite pointless are not allowed into the recommendations. So moving on to the evaluation process. We looked at how these reports are planned, how tenders are put out and bids placed, how the terms of reference are formulated, and also how the reports are written, and then in the final instance, used or not used. And the relevant axis, the different aspects of this axis comes up constantly. Are evaluators to function as auditors, or are they more to function like process facilitators? And these are kind of aspects of the two functions that we're trying to highlight. Is their function mainly to enact a sort of control, or is it to create an impetus for change? And finally, should they prioritize external trust or internal trust? Our informants had plenty to say about all of these contradictions, or all of these double functions, you could say. But the main point is that each of them created problems for the other part. So if they imagine for a moment that evaluators are to function more as auditors, that meant they could not function as facilitators and vice versa. If you take evaluators in as facilitators, they lose their critical distance and they won't be able to enact audit and control. And they will have another function in terms of trust. So you'll be able to involve them in an evaluation team or something like that, but you won't in the same way serve the kind of accountability to a wider public or even to political leadership. So we looked into who writes and who reads reports. There are some differences between Norway and Sweden on this count, but a large part of these reports are written by external consultants, and this is kind of a micro universe of this trouble that we're trying to focus. Use of external consultants, it does respond to a call for independence and critical distance, which obviously function as accountability mechanisms. You know, if you bring in people from the outside, there is an assumption that they will do so more objectively, with more distance, and that that the institution being evaluated will have to stand to account, as it were. However, these consultants may have a disincentive to perform critique. Some other of our informants said that, well, actually, in some cases, they perform more critique than what we actually find is valuable, you know? But then, again, you see this axis being played out. So if they are either driven to critique because they're motivated by an idea of representing independence, or on the other hand, they rely on, well, this is the assumption anyway, they rely on more projects, on retaining a good relation to the employer and so on. And so there's the disincentive to critique. There's also at least the potential for failure in arriving at appropriate recommendations. And this is not precisely the point I made with reference to the texts, because here the problem is more that even if the recommendations follow from description and analysis, it might be that certain recommendations simply aren't practicable given the context in which aid work is performed. And finally, there is this scenario, and it, to some extent I think it's real, that to the extent you use external evaluators, learning remains, or at least it's taken from this situation within the aid system and taken out. I mean, those who learn most from an evaluation process are those doing the evaluation. And who reads reports then? And here we have no clear answer, but the tendency is quite clear. Practically all our informants say that few people involved in aid work have the time to read evaluation reports and to absorb their content. So one of our informants said that our absorption capacity is zero, or it's like zero. And another informant described that there's often great enthusiasm at the start because everybody wants to support an initiative and everybody supports evaluation in principle and in general terms. But then when the process gets going, and especially when the report is done, enthusiasm has kind of evaporated, you know, because everybody has too much to read, and, oh, here's another report, and there's another, and there's another. And you're lucky if you even get to go through the executive summary. And people also said this quite explicitly. Like one said, we know that reports are not read. Okay, so Desmond.
Thank you very much. Okay, so evaluation is always part of a wider political and institutional context. As one of our interviewees described it, a power field of diverging concerns and interests. Now, you could say, well, that's what's new about that. I mean, that is the case with most government activities. But there's a couple of things that are maybe special about aid and aid evaluation. I mean, one, of course, is that the beneficiaries are the intended beneficiaries are far away. They're not represented. Hopefully their interests are represented through the aid agency, but they themselves are not part of that process. But also, I would argue that the question is continually asked, you know, does aid work? Does aid really work? We're hearing this for 30, 40 years. And you don't hear the question, you know, does education work or does medical treatment work? I mean, my point is that aid has a sort of question mark hanging over it, which to some extent makes it problematic all the time. It's not just this project or this policy that's under being studied or questioned. It's aid itself sort of implicitly in the background. And, of course, aid is a risky business. It's easy to criticize because it happens far away in distant countries and different you don't exercise control. It's difficult to manage aid. But also the challenges are so huge. The multidimensional problem which is faced in so many poor countries is enormously challenging. So it's a risky business, and we know a lot of mistakes are made, and it would be extraordinary if that were not the case. But it is therefore quite easy to find lots of projects that fail or examples of corruption. If you are critical to aid, it's not difficult to go out and find scandal stories to criticize. So it is risky, and that makes it unfortunately subject to excess, perhaps, criticism. And this, I would argue, puts aid on the defensive. I mean, in a historical perspective, over several decades, I would say that aid is currently on the defensive. And accountability in that circumstance tends to become of higher importance. So justifying expenditure on aid to the taxpayer becomes the highest priority, rather than learning, which involves being self-critical and open, so that especially in a political context where aid is on the defensive, this tension of perhaps even contradiction becomes exaggerated. So, on the background of this, what's to be done? Well, we have two main recommendations. The first is, arising out of what I've just been saying, we need to adjust our expectations to both aid interventions and to aid evaluations. When I say we, I'm talking about all of us who are, or you and or we, who are involved in the business of aid. Simply to recognise, to be honest, both inside and outside aid organisations, about just how risky and difficult aid is. And also how difficult it is to measure results, the emphasis on quantification all the time. We have to recognise that this is difficult and say so explicitly. So that we then must talk openly, I suggest, about the trade-offs between accountability and learning. There is a lot of evidence, we argue, on the basis of our work, that there is such a trade-off. But we think it would be helpful, indeed necessary, to be open about this and discuss it. I would argue that non-specialists, it may even seem obvious that there are some of the tensions, some of the points that Christian was just making. So why not be open about them and discuss them? So we end then with what we call four choices. This is a way of trying to formulate our conclusions in a way which would encourage debate. So the first question is, does the evaluation process need an evaluation report? And if so, what kind? I mean, several of those we interviewed emphasised the importance of the process more than the product. That's the one that really matters, at least for learning. And so maybe too much focus is put on the evaluation report itself. For learning purposes, a standardised terms of reference and a standardised report format may, in fact, not be the most helpful. Maybe we need to be more flexible in the sort of reports that we produce and that we call for. Secondly, does the evaluation process benefit from an external evaluation team? The argument, the limitations, the challenges of having external consultants. The point about this is that learning may be enhanced by using self-evaluations. I think the idea of including self-evaluations, or sometimes even replacing an evaluation by a self-evaluation, can be very worthwhile. But even more modest is to involve internal people, insiders, more in the process of evaluations. And should the evaluation always include recommendations? We heard of some of the limitations of what we found in the reports. And instead, perhaps a more effective way would have a good description and analysis which form the basis for debate. So rather than recommendations, then have your description, your analysis, and then let that be the basis for a debate in which those involved come themselves with recommendations. Given this problem, given this analysis of the situation, what recommendations might we come up with? This would certainly increase ownership, and I would think probably increase a degree of commitment to the recommendations. So finally, should accountability systems be given the current priority by donors, even when they come at the expense of internal learning? Now, this is the bottom line, the central issue of our report. So I will stop there and say that we look forward to hearing your views, and also we do very much hope that our work can lead to constructive debate. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much for this very effective and efficient run-through here, raising a lot of issues that I hope we'll be able to talk further on.